global phenomenon, and we know that religions are in closer interactions today. So that's the main reason that why we need to do a Hindu-Christian reflection and basing on the spirit, indwelling of the spirit. Okay. So as I said, in Hinduism, it's not a unified religion, so you can't pinpoint the essence of Hinduism. It's more like a tree that has grown over the time, over the period, than like a building that has been erected by a great architect at one point of time. So K.C. Sen very beautifully says that it's like a tree which has grown over the time. So you see a number of influences within Hinduism, number of cultures influenced Hinduism, religions influenced Hinduism. So the culture and religion of Aryan influence, and then Dravidian influence, before Aryans, Dravidian influence, then Aryans, and different invaders, Islam, influence of Islam, Buddhism, Sikhism, Jainism, which came out of Hinduism, but in turn it influenced Hinduism a lot. So, and then Western influence, and it's like a big tree that just keeps on growing, so there is no end, and it is vast, and we can't just say, okay, Hinduism I can teach, or I can do Hinduism in one semester, or so it keeps on growing, because that's one positive aspect about Hinduism, positive point about Hinduism. According to Monier Williams, it's ever widening, and it can take anything into its ever widening fold. So it has got something to offer to each mind. So any human tendencies, any human characteristic. So it has got something to offer a person who wants to seek God in seclusion. So it has got something to offer a person who is philosophically minded, who is a seeker, and he has got something to take from Hinduism. And aesthetic aspect, someone who is interested in poem and aesthetic spirit. So it has got something to give to such people. And for a practical person, so we have a congenial side, practical side of Hinduism. So it has got something to offer to each mind. So this is Hinduism, and as I said, we can't speak about the essence of Hinduism, but generally there are some patterns of thinking that we can introduce about Hinduism. So that's what I'm going to do now. So what are the patterns of thinking, general patterns of thinking within Hinduism? Mission or theology in India, in the Indian context, begins by learning to think within culture. So for example, this Indian road, so you see, there's a police jeep, auto rickshaws, buses, then walking men, women and children, and sometimes a bridegroom on a pony with a great precision heading to the wedding hall. Wandering cows with little interest in the traffic regime, or no interest in traffic regime whatsoever, all mix and move at different speed. So in India, it's not that we don't have traffic rules, but it's more context sensitive, negotiating on each moment with one another, each other giving way to each other and accommodating each other, thus moving towards each one's destination, trying to reach the destination on time. So traffic is one example to show how we think within culture. It is not so much of rule bound or external rules, but it is context sensitive. It is context sensitive rather than rule bound. So this is just one example to show how we think within culture. So not an external rule, we are within culture, and we are doing within the context and being sensitive to the context. Okay. Next, I want to use some of the images and symbols from Indian culture and religion. Peacock, the Indian national bird, peacock, when it spreads, opens and spreads its spectacular fan, it displays an impressive array of eyes, symbolizing there are multiple ways of seeing things. That's one thing that we learn from Hinduism. There are multiple ways of seeing things. And here, Shiva, one of the gods of Hindus, Shiva has three eyes. He has two eyes, and if you observe, Shiva has three eyes. Again, symbolizing that infinite vision. An infinite vision forever exceeds finite partial vision. Also, it challenges single perception and emphasizes a complexity of perceiving reality. And again, the same point, multiple ways of seeing things. And the Indian national flag, the wheel in the middle, this suggests there is a dialogic relationship between one and the many. So it's actually symbolizing and the Gandhi's homespun cotton campaign during independence struggle, the struggle for independence. But apart from that, it also symbolizes there is a dialogic relationship between one and the many. The spokes intend to show that there is life in movement, death in stagnation. So these symbols suggest that one and the many, there are multiple ways of seeing things, and one and the many can exist together, or a dialogic relationship between one and the many. So this is another pattern of thinking comes within Hinduism. Dance normally, usually, it has got some spiritual element. According to Sunil Kothari, a social analyst, oscillation between pose and movement is a rhythm that is particular to Indian classical dance. Oscillation between pose and movement, and there is a close relationship between sculpture and dance. Dance appears as mobile sculpture, sculpture appears as frozen dance. So this takes us beyond binary conception. And again, this Shiva, in the last picture, Shiva has three eyes. And this is another image of Shiva, a dancing Shiva. In this dance, we see an implicit in this movement. It's a movement, but we see an implicit pose in this movement. So this takes us, again quoting Sunil Kothari, so it takes us from exclusive parts to inclusive whole. Somehow in these dances, the temporality of movement and the spatiality of shape are overcome in this movement. So beyond binary conception to the inclusive whole, or from exclusive part to inclusive whole. So this is another pattern that we encounter in Hinduism, beyond binary conception, or from exclusive parts to inclusive whole. The state Gujarat is, it's a state, one of the states in India. The state Gujarat is known for embroidery work. But if we observe very closely, I haven't got a very good picture, but I'll try to make my point here. If we observe very closely, within the embroidery reveals a kind of healthy asymmetry, irregularity in its design. Somewhere in its design, there will be some incompatibility, irregularity, incoherence in the design. For example, within in a row of roses, you have X shape inserted in a row of roses, or that one thread, bright blue, the color bright blue thread breaks into green and then some other color. So there is a kind of healthy asymmetry in its design. So it suggests there is space for contradictions within Indian thinking, incompatibilities. Space for contradictions, irregularity, incompatibilities within Indian thinking. Transferring this thought to metaphysics, an Indian poet, Rabindranath Tagore, says, there's a point where all the contradictions meet in the mystery of existence. Movement is not all movement. Stillness is not all stillness. Form and idea within and without meet, where infinite becoming finite, not losing its infinity. And when this meeting point is lost, things become unreal. So there is space for contradictions within Indian thinking, but there is a point where contradictions meet. I didn't get a very good picture, but it's a rural festival painting, Indian festival painting. Always the human beings are within nature. They are portrayed as part of nature or within nature. And for an Indian, banyan tree is sacred. There are several rivers that are sacred. Mountains are sacred. And sacred places are scattered everywhere in India, so they can see the whole India as a sacred phenomenon. So this is, again, it gives a picture that human beings are part of nature, and that gives a kind of cultural unity. According to a theologian, Chettimattam, it gives a cultural unity because they consider everything as part of nature. Human beings are part of nature, and they consider the whole India, the Mother India, they call it Mother India, as a sacred phenomenon. So it gives us a kind of ecological metaphysics. So that's another point within Hindu thinking. So this is a drawing made by women. It has got many names. It's called Rangoli or Kolam, many other names. So it's basically drawing made by women to decorate the courtyard, dining hall, or the prayer room, walls, floor. So to decorate home and the worship place as well. It's made by rice flour and spices and other kitchen stuff. So when women do this, it's the kneeling and crouching position itself is like saying a prayer, because it is repetitive and it is calming. It's like saying a prayer or saying a rosary, chanting. Also, it's like paying a penance. And it is made by rice flour, so that even the little creature like ant, when it takes this offered food, it spreads the prayer wherever it goes. So that's why it is made by rice flour. And it is kind of invocation. So people worship God or seek God in the natural context of daily life. So it's touch with transcendence. The patterns, the circle, triangle, line, square, all these paradoxical patterns is symbolize the totality. So the paradoxical patterns, like all the square, circle, and triangle. So this, again, the paradoxes can coexist and it forms totality. And they are called writings because this is the language of relationship. So again, we get another point, the touch with transcendence from the natural context of everyday life, touch with transcendence. So with this general introduction to Indian thinking, Shall we switch it off? This general introduction, I want to introduce Upanishadic epistemology. According to a philosopher called Aurobindo Ghosh, India exists in spirit. It believes in the universal spirit, and that mostly come across in Upanishads. So what are these Upanishads? Upanishads, again, part of major scripture of Hinduism. So in order to understand Upanishads, let's go back to the Vedic religion. So the main characteristics of Vedic religion is this. In Vedas and Vedic religion, we see a human being, a man or human being, standing, watching the outside world with joy and wonder. So he adored the glory of sun, the beauty of dawn, and he admired nature. But at the same time, he feared nature. So he worshipped nature because he believed rain, wind, sun, all these have got power, living power. So he worshipped nature. So if we see all the gods of Vedic religion or nature gods, the religion is very active religion, and so much emphasis on priesthood, spoken word had power, and spoken word, emphasis on spoken word, spirit, priesthood, and the sacrifice. They offered sacrifice in the open, in the open space around the fire. So that was Vedic religion. That was some of the characteristics of Vedic religion. So an external religion, worshipping nature and seeing the nature in joy and wonder, as well as they feared nature. So if that is Vedic religion, when we come to Upanishadic religion, this religion is something inward. So you have an inner splendor of vision within Hindu Upanishadic thinking. So it is a reaction to the external sacrifices, rituals of Vedic religion. So in Upanishadic, the man who adored nature outside, he goes within and he is trying to adore within himself his inner nature. From many, he goes into one. So that is Upanishadic religion. Upanishads, basically, they are dialogues between a student and a teacher. Okay? So, and they asked many questions. Why am I existing? What is the reason of my existence? And where do we come from? By what power we live? And what is the cause of all these things? Is time the cause? Is nature the cause? Or is it by accident? Or the combination of all these things? None of these things could give a satisfactory answer because of the existence of soul. So again, Upanishadic religion focused on soul within, the inner nature, inner man. So God can be found within. So in the Vedic religion, if it is outside, God is found outside, worshipped outside. In Upanishadic religion, God is found within. So that's where I find similarities or parallels between many traditions. Sufi tradition, again, you have the same idea. Then Christianity, it's not uncommon in Christianity, finding God within. So Upanishads, as I mentioned, it's a dialogue between, mostly dialogue. These are collections of many, there are many Upanishads, 112 Upanishads, 18 Upanishads are principal Upanishads. Brihadaranyaka, Isha, Chandogya Upanishad, these are some of the oldest Upanishads. There are many dialogues about life, about soul, and how to know Brahman. Brahman is the ultimate reality, our supreme reality, all-pervading spirit in Upanishads. One such dialogue goes like this. A disciple, a student, with all reverence, he asks the teacher, "Sir, please tell me, how can I know Brahman? How to know Brahman?" And the teacher doesn't answer. He doesn't give a reply. After a while, the student is led to ask a question. Who am I? So the teacher is asking the student to ask a question. So ask a question. And he's led to ask a question to himself. Who am I? So the question itself, who am I, reduces the spirit to silence. And silence itself, in turn, truth and reality. So the student asks, okay, I ask myself, who am I? I am a woman. I'm an Indian, I'm a student. So all the externals I can accumulate, I can speak of all my externals. But there comes a stage, all my externals vanish. One by one, all my externals vanish. I am left with my bare, naked self. So when I come to that stage, the teacher interrupts and says, surely one who has known the lightning flash within has known Brahman or has known the ultimate reality. If you have known the lightning flash within, it just happens. And you don't have to go to books and learn. You don't have to conceptualize. It is something which happens within. Surely one who has known the lightning flash within has known Brahman, and there is no other evidence, there is no other proof needed. Okay, so one who has encountered himself within has encountered God. One who has... I am very, very sorry. Sorry, extremely sorry. So one who has encountered himself, one who has not encountered himself within has not encountered God. One who has encountered himself within has encountered God. And God cannot be known apart from encountering myself within, and I cannot be known apart from speaking about God simultaneously. So God, I cannot speak about myself without speaking about God at the same time. Cannot speak about God without speaking about myself. So it is knowing within means I know myself. At the same time, when I know myself within, I know God. So this is the ultimate reality which is there, which is found within. That's the main focus of Upanishadic religion. There's another dialogue. I'll tell you another dialogue. This is between a king by name Janaka. So it was an usual practice.